This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're going to start today with that phone call that every academic dreams of getting someday.
Well, my cell phone rang at 4 in the morning, and it said Sweden on the phone, so I had a pretty good idea what that might be.
Indeed, it was the Nobel Committee, and they were calling University of Chicago professor Richard Thaler to inform him that he'd been awarded the 2017 Nobel Prize in Economics. Thaler is a pioneer in behavioral economics, a powerfully influential field that marries psychology and economics to produce better models of human decision-making. And today, Thaler said the basic premise of his work is, quote, "In order to do good economics, you have to keep in mind that people are human." Well, joining us now is someone who knows Richard Thaler very well, Cass Sunstein. He's professor at Harvard Law School and a close friend of Thaler's. He co-authored a book with Richard Thaler called Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. Professor Sunstein, welcome back to Radio Boston.
I'm great to be here. Thank you so much.
So first of all, have you been able to speak with Richard Thaler today?
I have indeed. I spoke to him around 7 in the morning, our time, 6 in the morning his time, and he sounded wide awake.
Wide awake and thrilled that his work has been honored in this way. I mean, so what was your reaction that he'd been awarded the Nobel Prize?
Completely thrilled. So he's as influential an economist as there is on the face of the earth, and he's not only altered how people do economics and think about economic theory, he's also had a great impact on what both the private and public sectors are doing. So to see recognition for someone who's a great guy but also made the world better, that's pretty good.
Yeah. You know, when we talk about behavioral economics today, we talk about it as, you know, somewhat a matter of fact, that of course it makes sense that this idea that we have to consider human beings as not totally rational actors should play a role in how we think about economics. But obviously, it wasn't always thus. So can you take us back to the time where you were first introduced to the notion and what difference it made to you?
Yeah. So in the 1980s, in economics and basically law and political science, lots of fields, the idea is people are rational, meaning that if people smoke, it's because they enjoy it and they've calculated the benefits of smoking and they outweigh the costs. Or if people invest in one stock or another, that's kind of what they want to do. Or if people take a job, maybe there are big risks associated with it, but they're making rational choices. And this is actually very productive, and people who have had ideas like this have won their own Nobel Prizes, and those are well-deserved. But there are a lot of skeptics out there saying, come on, we know people who made crazy investments and who are addicted to smoking and who've taken jobs because they haven't really thought much about the alternatives or about the risks, let's say, associated with the job they took. And that kind of, let's call it clueless skepticism, was very much in the air. What Thaler did more than anyone, really, was to say, look, people are not fully rational, and here's exactly how.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd go through about 5 different ways early in his career, and by now there are about, you know, 18 different ways, and each is very specific and empirically demonstrated, and a lot of them you wouldn't just intuit. You could be skeptical about the economic theory, but what the alternative was, you can't develop that from the seat of the pants, and Thaler really developed the alternative.
Yeah. So describe to us some of the things that he elucidated here. I mean, I was reading a little earlier today about something that Professor Thaler called the endowment effect.
Yeah, okay. We'll do a little endowment effect experiment on this call. Okay. Suppose you're holding a lottery ticket and it has a certain number. Then someone goes up to you and says, I'll buy it from you for $8 or $12 or $14. Would you sell? If you're like most people, you'd be kind of reluctant to sell, thinking, this is my lottery ticket. I might get a big payoff here. Now take it another way. Suppose someone comes up to you and says, I have a lottery ticket. You want to buy it for $10, $12, $14? You might well say, that's crazy.
Right.
I don't want to buy a lottery ticket. So the endowment effect means if you have something, chances are you're going to hold on to it, a little like a tiger, and you're going to demand more to give it up than you would be willing to pay to get in the first place. And whether we're talking about household goods or sweaters or jobs or spouses, the endowment effect is really important. And you can't understand kind of social and economic life without seeing that people's attachment to the things they now have way outruns how much they'd be willing to pay to get exactly those things if they didn't have them. And the endowment effect is actually instantaneous, and it helps explain some good marketing strategies, which make it seem as if you kind of already have this thing. Do you want to give it up?
Mm-hmm.
No. And it also helps explain some things that the government has done, which have paid attention to this aspect of the human mind.
Yeah. And so this is a perfect example of how powerful this notion of behavioral economics is, right? Because it's one way to understand more in depth why, I don't know, conventional models of markets don't always play out as one, you know, as algorithms or equations would predict them to play out in real life, right? When we have actual humans in those markets. And secondly, as you were pointing out, it helps sort of potentially guide policy. Now, we've seen some major changes that have come through the research that Professor Thaler and others have done. I mean, for example, now there are companies, I believe, who automatically enroll people into retirement savings plans, and you have to opt out instead of opt in.
Completely. So we have a problem in the United States, and many countries have this problem, which is that people don't save enough for retirement. And one reason is they don't bother to get around to enrolling in plans from which they benefit. And if you just switch the rule from do you want to opt in to do you want to opt out, you can have a huge increase in participation rates. And actually, we've observed that in the United States, where automatic enrollment, which completely preserves freedom, if you don't want to be in the plan, you can get out, but automatic enrollment boosts retirement participation rates massively. And all over the United States, employers are doing this, and it's a policy tool that has a very big impact on people's future that doesn't cost the taxpayers a nickel.
Yeah. So to get back to Professor Thaler specifically, I love the fact that he's at the University of Chicago, right? Because that's like the bastion of uber-rationalistic, you know, economic thought for I don't know, generations. And in fact, he commented on that he said that he knew it would be kind of a fight to introduce his ideas to his fellow faculty members there.
Yeah, I remember a workshop where he and I presented one of our early papers on what we're now talking about, how people depart from rationality and the implications of that for law and policy. And we gave it in front of the kind of true believers in people are rational. And it was like a war. I mean, faculty discussions are sometimes heated. This was, no one who has been at that workshop will ever forget it. People remember it decades later. And the degree of anger at Thaler and me in the room was really, really high. And Thaler, to his great credit, being attacked, you know, being completely unscientific and foolish and, you know, basically a hopeless case, he was funny and very cool. Afterwards, he wasn't a happy camper, but it shows you that, you know, the stakes are pretty high. And if you're thinking about environmental policy or what to do about smoking or what to do about opioid addiction or what to do about climate change, Thaler's work opens up a whole host of tools.
Yeah.
And it can get, you know, pretty heated, whether the tool is a form of manipulation or whether it's a good idea.
Right. So let me ask you about that, because, I mean, there's the pushback that he received from classical economists, but also I think there's some pushback from folks who see the use of behavioral economics in policymaking as potentially paternalistic or manipulative, to use your word.
Well, I worked in the White House for 4 years under President Obama, and the range of things we did in the policy domain is very large, but a number of things we did were informed by Thaler's work, and as I think about it, not one of them was politically controversial. So when you buy a car, you know, this year you'll see a fuel economy label, which is telling you about the money you'll spend with a fuel-efficient or non-fuel-efficient car. It gives you a bunch of simple information about things most consumers care about, and that is definitely informed by Thaler's work. One thing we did was to work on automatically enrolling kids in free lunch and breakfast plans to which they are entitled if they're poor, and this was a way of saying, you know, if your parents don't sign you up because they're scared scared of the letter they received, or because the letter's too complicated, or because they're too busy, or whatever, still you're in the program and you get the meals to which you're entitled. And that automatic enrollment plan was very welcomed by people on Republican and Democratic sides.
Yeah.
So I could list, easily 60 initiatives that are making a real impact on the lives of many millions of people. And it's hard to think of any one that was really politically divisive. So there's kind of noise among some talk show hosts about how nudges or uses of behavioral economics are one step away from George Orwell and communism. But the irony is that these things are like a GPS device. They tell you where to go if you want to get there, but if you don't like what the GPS is saying, you don't like the default rule, you don't like the reminder, you don't like the information, you want a gas-guzzling car, you're perfectly entitled to go in the direction you want.
Right.
But some of these initiatives are saving lives, and others are saving a lot of money, and they're really not on the view screen of a political party that is, that's agitated about something.
So last question for you, Professor Sunstein. Today, Professor Thaler talked about how there's something of a generational divide, and we touched on it earlier. He says that, most economists under the age of 40 are fully on board with the behavioral economics framework, perhaps not so true amongst older folks. But then he was also saying that he thinks that eventually all economics will be as behavioral as the topic requires. Do you think that's true, that it's inevitable?
No question. And the real excitement, I think, not comes from the triumph of behavioral economics, but from the use of behavioral economics to help confront policy problems that we face, like over 40,000 people died on the highways in 2016. What are we going to do about that? We have a problem of, persistent poverty in the United States. How can we help? So as a problem-solving tool, we're going to see immense creativity, and I think that's where both the action and theory and practice is going to be in the future.
Yeah. And Professor Thaler absolutely demonstrated what I believe is a pretty good sense of humor today when he was asked how he's going to spend the money that comes along with the Nobel Prize, and he said, I will try to spend it as irrationally as possible.
Yeah, I'm going to help him not do that.
Well, Cass Sunstein is a professor at Harvard Law School and a good friend of Richard Thaler. Richard Thaler was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics today. They co-wrote the book Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. Thanks so much, Professor Sunstein.
All thanks to you.